Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with Nancy Lemon about her long-awaited new novel, The Oyster Diaries, and we'll hear from Jane Fulton Ault. Her new book is Still Life, A Photographer's Journey Through Grief and Gardening.
Nancy Lemon is a New Orleans native whose novels include Lives of the Saints, Sportsman's Paradise, The Fiery Pantheon in Melez, and the nonfiction work The Writs of the Bayou, recently reissued in a gorgeous and charming 40th anniversary edition. A new novel, The Oyster Diaries, was published in April. That is an embarrassment of riches for readers. Nancy Lemon, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan, so much.
First, congratulations on the return of The Writs of the Bayou. Purple, green, and gold never looked so good on a book cover.
Right. This is very heroic publisher in South Carolina. It's called Hub City Press.
Now, this month also brings a reprint of your first novel, The Lives of the Saints, which was originally published in 1985. So was it different rereading fiction than nonfiction?
I did reread The Writs of the Bayou because I had to write that afterward. And
right.
While I read it, I did a few edits on it. But Lives of the Saints, I tried to read it. I just couldn't read it. I mean, every time I tried to edit it, it was like, okay, well, then if you tone this down, the whole thing is not going to work. You know, there's just something. And so then I told my editor at NYRB this, and he said, yeah, don't touch it.
Don't touch it. Oh. Now, that was a time, 1985, that was a time when New Orleans women's voices were really out there. There was your wonderful book. There was Sheila Bosworth's Almost Innocent, Ellen Gilchrist's Victory Over Japan. Your Louise Brown was really there charming her way into readers' hearts, along with so many other creations of New Orleanians, just as Delery Anhalt is in The Oyster Diaries. You know, we kind of had to wait for Delery Anhalt to grow up to have this book.
Absolutely, because I do think a lot of the saints, that has the verve and vision of youth.
Mm-hmm.
It just, and then The Oyster Diaries is totally age.
Now, one of the things that I love so much is that Walker Percy, who was such a profound influence on you, makes a direct appearance in this book. And Delery's getting ready to drive across the causeway, and a storm is blowing up, and Walker tells her that the next half hour or so will be good for her soul. So tell us a bit about your friendship with Walker Percy and what he meant to you.
He was my hero before I ever met him.
Mm-hmm.
I never dreamt I would meet him, much less become his friend. And it was because I went to school with his nephew who brought me to have lunch over there one day. So meeting your actual hero.
Yeah.
I mean, it just doesn't get any better than that. It just does not. And he was 40 years older than me. My editor, Gordon Lish, also was a white-haired gent. That's
uh-huh.
The kind I have a weakness for. Both of them were just like gods who stood astride the earth to me. And I think about Walker so incessantly right now with all this happening. I just don't know why exactly. Except that he was so modest.
Well, you probably know a lot of what he would say, but that doesn't replace the pleasure of actually hearing him say it.
Yeah, I mean, I know some of what he would say.
Yeah, sure.
For sure. He would tell me, just go back to your writing, you know, stop doing all this stuff. But, you know, I guess he did some of this type of stuff, but I'm sure he was much more articulate and intellectual, but although he did have kind of a southern, you know, good old boy side to him.
Mm-hmm. But don't you think it was important to you to have Walker Percy kind of, you know, when you're that young, you need some writer to show you how being a writer is done, to model that behavior and devotion.
Totally, totally. And he would always, whenever I would, you know, I knew him when I was so young. I was very immature. There's so many questions I wish now, and as I got older, that I could have asked him, but I was too immature to ask him at the time. But I would occasionally ask him about my little problems, and he would always say, that's not your problem, my business problems. And he'd say, that's not your problem. You just write.
Mm-hmm.
You know, other people should handle that. And he was just so down to earth and knew the right way to do everything, as you said.
So you had this really wonderful fairy tale like experience with Gordon Lish for your first
book. Total fairy tale. It does not happen. It was before computers, it was typewriters. So you had this physical manuscript, and I was in New York at Columbia Graduate School, and I had seen Gordon Lish give a lecture, and I had just had a real revelation that he might be just enough of a nut to take a chance on me. So I went over to Alfred A. Knopf with clutching my physical manuscript, and I asked the receptionist if Gordon Lish was there. And I guess he came out to the reception and he said, I'm racing, babe, what is it? And so I just handed him the manuscript and I said, this is my heart's blood. Okay, and then this was on a Friday.
Mm-hmm.
He called me on Monday, and instead of just acting normal, he said, you and me, kid, we're going straight to the top. And that's how he talked. And he still had to show it to his boss, Bob Gottlieb.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, will you be willing to make changes? And then this thing came over me that comes over you like three times in your life where you suddenly turn into a business tycoon or something. And I said, well, after the contract, right? I don't even know where that came from, but I do know where it came from because John Kennedy Toole had just worked with Bob Gottlieb without a contract for quite a while.
Yeah.
And we all know what eventually happened there.
Wow. That is just so, I mean, did you have any sense of how rare and remarkable that was?
That I thought to say that?
Well, know that the whole thing happened.
Yeah, no, I think so. I must have. I mean, it was rare then. It would never happen now. I mean, it would be equally rare if it ever did. I think, I'm pretty sure I did, but the whole thing was like that, the whole experience, just like it's like that now. And it seems kind of, I don't know, random or arbitrary, because there is that long period of what I like to call the doom in between. The doom is kind of longer than the other parts, but I guess you have to, like in my Chinese fortune cookie the other night, it said, failure is the tuition you pay for success.
Ah!
I mean,
did you keep it? Did you?
I did.
Did you tuck it away? I keep all my fortunes like that. Did you always know that New Orleans would be your great subject? Did you ever think maybe it's time to stop? Did you ever think maybe you should find something else?
Well, growing up there, you think it's normal because you don't know anything else. And mm-hmm. then when I went up north to college, it was just like, whoa, that is going to be the ace in my back pocket. And I do think if you get to learn about a strange place and the grounded, the structure going back, just the elegantly structured, deep-rooted air of it, that's a valuable thing. And so I do have that, and I don't think I've penetrated other places in the same way because it's just in your blood and bones and soul a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But now that my father is gone, it's completely different.
And I'm very sorry for that loss of your father. I know that was...
Thank you. I mean, he was 97.
He lived a good long life.
I'll say.
He loved books, I know that.
Absolutely.
I loved it when Nick described the books that your father would make of trips, you know, with photographs and records of places he had been. And you describe in this novel books that the mother keeps of her dinner parties.
Right.
Which are so charming and intriguing. And were those real? I have to know.
Absolutely.
I mean, inquiring minds.
Real. I have them right here in my office, and they're just these leather-bound books. They're just so quaint. I mean, this is all part of the New Orleans thing, that there was such an elaborate, deep-rooted life there that I did not provide that for my children. I must have provided something, because as someone asked me the other day when they were interviewing me, why do you think your kids are so nice to you? And I mean, I asked myself that a lot, because I didn't, you know, I felt my parents provided these deep things. I have this card from one of my father's best friends in my office where the first line is, I'll probably cry when I read it, but it says, my dear TBL, as my father loved your father, so do I love you. It goes on from there when you have those kind of roots, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It's just incredible. It's so deep.
Well, I liked being in solitary with Delery. I liked the way she was thinking about things. I liked that sense of her growing a spine. I really did. It made her seem like the sort of person we all ought to try and be right now.
I think she had some insights, yeah.
And she flailed a bit, no doubt about it.
Absolutely. And I mean, I was really tried to make that book as short as I could. I didn't. And I agree with the critics who say it's a tad bit disjointed, you know, here and there. But I just sensed that the doom was over and the doors were opening again and the lions at the gate had stopped snarling, and I needed to come up with something.
And there are real lions in this book. Let us be sure to say that.
Oh, right. Exactly. Yes.
All right. Well, we've been talking with Nancy Lemon, whose new novel is The Oyster Diaries. It's just been published along with reprints of her first novel, Lives of the Saints, and her first work of nonfiction, The Writs of the Bayou. You can meet Nancy Wednesday, May 6th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Nancy, thank you so much. Safe travels.
Thank you so much, Susan. It is such a pleasure to welcome award-winning photographer Jane Fulton Ault to The Reading Life. Jane began exploring the visual arts while pursuing her career as a clinical social worker, and now she lives and works on the shores of Lake Michigan in Evanston, Illinois, in close proximity to the Mississippi River in New Orleans. Jane is the author of Look and Leave, Photographs and Stories of New Orleans' Lower Ninth Ward, and The Burn. Today, we're talking about her new book, Still Life, A Photographer's Journey Through Grief and Gardening. Jane, welcome.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Now, with this book, your husband Howard Ault's garden becomes a gift that keeps on giving to everyone. So let's hear a little bit about your late husband and this project.
Sure. So we have a home in Evanston, Illinois, on the campus of Northwestern University, and we're on a corner, and he loved gardening, and he kind of put it aside for a while we were raising our children. And in his 70s, he decided that he was going to start a native garden, unbeknownst to me. He didn't really talk about it. And in fact, the first bed that he pulled up, all the grass, was on the parkway, and it wasn't even our property. It was city property. And you couldn't see it from our house. I didn't understand what he was doing. But as he said, it's always easier to ask for forgiveness than permission.
Right.
So,
I admire that.
Yeah. So, and it was about a year before our daughter was getting married, a home wedding, and he was pulling up the lawn. And I was kind of horrified, but, you know, he was determined to do what he wanted to do, which was to start this native garden.
And there are these two sentences that are so lovely. I was never a gardener. Then my husband died, leaving behind an extensive, newly planted native garden. their worlds in those two sentences.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, he died very unexpectedly, and he had spent a lot of time in the Lurie Gardens in Chicago, which was all Native. And my daughter was in touch with them about starting, you know, someplace where people contribute money. And the director of the Lurie Gardens said to my daughter shortly after Howard died, like within days, tell your mother that we will help her with her garden. And that was about the kindest thing that anybody could have ever said to me, because it was really looming large, you know.
Of course.
Yeah, yeah. So this director came with a couple of other people, and this intern who was working with Roy Diblick, who was a gardener, started working with me. And really what he did is he gave me permission just to garden. I didn't have to know everything.
Nice.
Yeah. And, you know, I kind of am learning as I'm going along. And I still don't consider myself very knowledgeable, but I'm finding that, you know, if I pay attention to the plants, they'll let me know what they need. And it's also been an incredible conduit to Howard, you know, working in the garden.
So how many seasons has it been now for you?
We're going on 7.
That's a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And did you start photographing the garden right away?
You know, I had been photographing the garden before he passed away. In fact, the still lives at the front of the book were done the spring before he passed away. And they were inspired really by Mother's Day gift of peonies that I got. And then the tulips were done before he had passed away, too. And then the third section of the book was all done after he passed away.
And when did you really begin to realize what a gift this garden was?
I would say he passed away in September, pretty immediately. So he had left, you know, he was very generous and abundant, and he had bought a whole flat of honeysuckles that he hadn't planted before he died. One thing that always bugged me was how these plants would be sitting there. You know, they need to go in the ground. So I felt a lot of pressure to figure out how to get them in the ground shortly after he died. And once I learned about the honeysuckles and where they might thrive, I started to go around the garden to plant them. And unbeknownst to me, Howard had already put a number of them in the ground exactly where I was going to put them.
Oh, what a wonderful moment of synchronicity.
Yep, yep. So that was the beginning of the gift.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And when did you start to see this as a book?
Shortly after he passed away. You know, I had done 2 other books, and I just felt like I had another book in me. And, you know, it's been a long process. It's been 6 years. And initially, I just kind of threw anything that was garden plant related together. And it was more like a catalog versus a narrative. And it took a lot of people helping me in the process to narrow it down and figure out how to present the work in some way that made sense about my journey.
Well, the thing that's magical about a garden is that it has a built-in narrative of the seasons, of time, of cycles of plants.
Totally.
So you have got 3 marvelous, marvelous essays accompanying your photographs. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about those. The first is James Barris in The Great Transformation. And James describes how suffering, the first of the Buddha's 4 noble truths, can be transformed into beauty.
Yeah, that essay, it just, I feel like it's a real cornerstone to the book. He talked about things that I didn't know that was what was happening to me. I mean, I learned more about myself and this whole process through the essay. I actually, shortly after I lost Howard, I was in deep grief, and I met with the social worker actually here in New Orleans, and she had suggested taking James's course, Awakening Joy, and I took it, and it was during COVID, and it was incredibly helpful. And then I decided to take a refresher 2 years later and learned that he was doing certification. So I became a teacher of the Awakening Joy. So, and I've been going on silent retreats with him. And so his contribution to this book, I mean, I feel like it really spans this whole period of time that I've been widowed. He kind of understands the human condition in a really deep way. And I just feel like essay was a incredible gift from him. And a blessing to the book.
It was lovely. And it's, you know, it's that old, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear moment.
Yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
And then Douglas Tallamy's essay, Gardening for the Future, is a fabulous story about how we need to coexist with nature in order to move forward.
Right, which is why Howard started what he started. He was so moved by Doug Tallamy's writings, Bringing Nature Home, Nature's Best Hope. And when anybody was walking by the garden and wondered what he was doing, because at that point nobody was doing native gardening, everybody had lawns, Howard would run and get a copy of the book and give it to somebody, you know, because I think that it was his way of trying to prepare for the climate crisis that we're in.
Well, I think the idea of being in your garden and handing out books is heavenly.
Yeah.
You know, you just put a little free library out there and stock it.
Actually, that's what I did last summer. I put a free library out there.
Aren't they great?
Yeah, they really are. They're really a wonderful thing.
They connect you to the world. They
right.
really do.
Yeah.
And finally, W.M. Hunt's Illumination talks about the meaning of the title in the lovely way that it means life continues and endures.
Yeah. He was the first person that ever collected my work, and he's kind of seen the whole change, or, you know, my growth as a photographer. I've known him for a number of years, and so he seemed like the right person to ask to write the essay, and his essay was so beautiful. And the still life is, actually, the title, Still Life, was suggested by my son-in-law, which is so perfect because I honestly feel more joy and gratitude than I've ever felt in my whole life now. Mm-hmm. I feel like this garden, and I do miss Howard, but I feel like I've incorporated him into my being now. Mm-hmm. And the garden. And, you know, talking about, because we're in New Orleans now, you know, he really, 14 years ago, he said, I think we should buy a piece of property. I said, oh, I don't think so. And he pushed it through. And every time I walk in the door, I say, thank you, Howard. I mean, I know he's around. It's just, mm-hmm. He's still, and I'm still collaborating with him. I mean, this conversation with you is a collaboration with him, too.
And how much time are you able to spend here and there? How do you divide your time?
It's garden related. Usually when the garden goes to sleep in October, and the birds, when the birds migrate, you know, when the season starts to change, it's time to head down here. And same with going up north. I mean, I'll be heading out in a few weeks to tend to the garden up north.
Well, it's lovely to have your ruminations along with the photographs along the way.
Thank you.
So it gives us a sense of what you're thinking and feeling, and it's just a lovely, lovely book, Jane.
Thank you so much. I so appreciate, you know, having this interview with you and being able to talk about it, because I feel like what I've learned through all this is that we are all so connected. We're so connected to the earth, to the plants, and to each other. It's about the love. And the more we can smile with each other, to each other, with each other, and the more community we can build, that's what's going to save us.
And the more beauty we will see.
Absolutely. I think beauty is so important, and noticing the beauty and savoring it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you have made a really beautiful book for people to cherish. So thank you for your work.
Oh, thank you so much, Susan. I really appreciate meeting you and having this opportunity to talk about the book.
My pleasure. We've been talking with Jane Fulton Ault, whose new book is Still Life, A Photographer's Journey Through Grief and Gardening. She will discuss her work with the talk, Threading the Needle, The Camera as a Companion, and a book signing at the New Orleans Photo Alliance, 7800 Oak Street, Tuesday, May 5th at 6. Jane also appears in conversation with Eve Abrams, Thursday, May 7th at 6 at Octavia Books. Jane, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap this week in the literary life. Michelle St. Romain appears in conversation with Rosalind Lemon and signs her new novel, Song of Belonging, Sunday, May 3rd at 3:30 at Octavia Books. Jack McGuire discusses Ensign's Killing the Kingfish, the Huey Long assassination, Monday, May 4th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Jane Fulton Ault discusses her new book, Still Life, A Photographer's Journey Through Grief and Gardening, with a talk, Threading the Needle, The Camera as Companion, with a book signing at the New Orleans Photo Alliance, 7800 Oak Street, Tuesday, May 5th at 6 p.m. Jane also appears in conversation with Eve Abrams, Thursday, May 7th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Nancy Lemon signs The Oyster Diaries Wednesday, May 6 at 6 at the Garden District Bookshop. And Sunday, May 3rd is the final day of the Literary Crawl celebrating Independent Bookstore Day, with a chance to win a grand prize and gift cards for those who visit and get their IBD passports stamped at all 11 participating New Orleans independent bookstores, including Octavia Books, Baldwin & Company, Blue Cypress Books, Community Book Center, Frenchman Art and Books, Garden District Bookshop, Tubby and Coos at the Good Shop, Crescent City Books, Faulkner House, Nomad Books, and Parlor Books. One lucky reader will win a gift card from each of the participating stores. Pick up your passport at any of the participating bookstores and get it stamped at each stop along the way, and turn it in at your last stop.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.